QSO Today, episode 486, Lanny Aldrich, K1LEC. This episode of QSO Today is listener-sponsored. Only you can keep the QSO Today podcast coming to you every weekend since 2014. Please become a listener sponsor monthly or annually by clicking on the sponsor banner on the show notes page or at the top of the QSOtoday.com webpage. This week's sponsors include Mark Farrell, VK6OP, $10. Grayson Evans, KJ7UM, $10. J. Gordon Betty Jr., W2TTT, $10. Adrian Lambert, M5ADL, $10. Robert Swain, W5APO, $10. Larry Classy, W4LEC, $10. And James Bender, KC3OPI, who saved 20% by taking an annual sponsorship of $100. These listeners made donations this week. Nate Phil, KA1MUQ, $50. Brian Whitaker, AG6WR, $100. Jordan Macauer, WA2BRV, $50. Martin Buring, KB4MG, $10. And Stephen Lehman, SM5YRA, $25. I want to thank all of you who contribute to keeping this podcast on the air and making it possible for me to continue it. Welcome to the QSO Today podcast. I'm Eric Uth, amateur call sign 4Z1UG, where I demonstrate the diversity and relevance of the amateur radio hobby and its impact on society by interviewing ham radio operators, many of whom played vital roles in shaping our technology through the amateur radio hobby. And while many people might say, "Ham radio? Do people still do that?" this podcast demonstrates through in-depth interviews just how amazing, diverse, and dynamic the amateur radio hobby continues to be. Just a few notes before we begin. I'm so excited that the Ham Radio Workbench podcast will celebrate its 200th episode in the next 2 weeks. In celebration, I was asked to be a guest on the podcast. Please join me there and find out what projects are on my Ham Radio Workbench. I want to wish George, KJ6VU, and his crew congratulations on 200. I can tell you that you don't need a riding mower to listen to their show. I use a large dog that needs 10,000 steps a day to keep us both trim. That is when I listen. I appreciate so much your replies to my blog posts. They serve as an outlet for dealing with the stresses that currently surround all of us who live in Israel that don't make the news elsewhere. I added a box on the right side next to my blog posts of the media that I consume that I'm sure is different from what you are hearing and reading. The contrast might interest you. Lanny Aldrich, K1LEC, began his professional career as a third-generation commercial dairy farmer in Vermont. Amateur radio was his hobby that he pursued at a steady pace by chasing DX, building operating skills, and contributing to the hobby by just being involved. Just his advice on antennas is a prize from our conversation. K1LEC is my QSO today. K1LEC, this is Eric, 4Z1UG. Are you there, Lanny?
I certainly am.
Lanny, thanks for joining me on the QSO Today podcast. Can we start at the beginning of your ham radio story? When and how did it start for you?
Well, that was a long time ago. I joined the Civil Air Patrol in the fall of 1958 as in their cadet program. My ambition was to fly. They had a J3 Cub that was really inexpensive to use. It was, I don't know, maybe it was $10 an hour, maybe it was less. And, you know, it was sort of like the Boy Scouts, but what it turned out to be was, for me, an introduction to ham radio. The cadet commandant was W1UWS, Harold Thompson, a World War II vet. And he became one of my two Elmers. The other Elmer was the wing commander, W1TIM, who was my neighbor. I was only 14, and living out in the country, I could grab a vehicle from the family business and just drive up to his place. And he gave me just open access to his shop and shack whenever I wanted.
Let's back up just a second here. What was WNTIM's name?
His name was Ed Merrick. WNTIM call is now held by his third son, his youngest son, Keith.
Let's back up even further. The hometown where you grew up?
Springfield, Vermont. I lived actually on a farm, a hillside farm in North Springfield, Vermont.
It's my understanding that your family had a family business there?
Yeah, we had initially a dairy farm that started selling milk retail in 1918. And, you know, my grandparents delivered by, well, depending on the season, by a wagon or a sleigh way back in the day. And it grew into quite a prosperous business.
So the family farm was intergenerational. So you were like the third generation on the farm.
Yes, I was.
Did you have an interest in electronics or anything like that before joining the Civil Air Patrol?
No, I did not. And it's always been just a hobby to me. I didn't go to college in any technical arena, really. Well, yeah, I guess I did. I got my degree in dairy manufacturing, which is somewhat technical.
Because you mentioned that you became a cadet in the Civil Air Patrol at age 14. I don't think that you could drive legally, or maybe out in the country you could drive vehicles without anybody stopping you, but could you actually fly airplanes at age 14?
Yes, I think I could have. You know, I'm not sure of that, but maybe at age 16, because I know 16-year-olds were flying.
Yeah, I think so. As a cadet, what would you do in the Civil Air Patrol?
Well, we had meetings and training, and it was sort of like Boy Scouts. You earned your way around, and we could participate in search and rescue when we were trained in that arena. It was sort of like Boy Scouts, in that it attracted young people. Not just, there didn't happen to be any female cadets when I was in there, but it's certainly well populated today with female cadets.
Did you become a pilot? Did you get your pilot's license?
No, I never did fly. That's another story. But I never did solo, I should say. If you want to jump into aviation, the summer after I graduated from college, I was on active duty in the Vermont Air National Guard. And across the field, there was a school. And I, for $100 in 1966, $100, I bought 10 hours of dual instruction and ground school, if you can believe it.
That's like $10 each for each session. Oh, that's an amazing price.
Yeah. So I think maybe that's where I'm thinking of the $10, not 1958.
But. Well, you know, on the one hand, on the other hand, I think that you said 1966. I think the average wage, a good take-home wage, was less than $10,000 a year.
Oh, yeah, certainly. When I started working full-time in the family business,
minimum wage might have been over a dollar.
It was. But I can tell you that when I got married, I remember that wage. I was on salary, and I was making $7,800 in 1968.
That was pretty good, right? That was middle class.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that was well above average.
So what happened then? You had two Elmers, Harold Thompson, W1UWS, and Ed Merrick, W1TIM. How did they pull you into amateur radio?
Well, just we had equipment there at the Civil Air Patrol, had its own building at the North Springfield Airport. It's called Harkness Airport. It's a Vermont state-operated airport. We had HF and 2 meters there, and that's how I got attracted to a 2 meter AM.
What kind of equipment do you remember? Was it the Gonsid communicator?
Oh, the 2 meters, I certainly remember well. The 2 meters was a Goonie box, you know, a Gonsid. Those came out in the 50s.
That was a yellow box. Your push to talk was actually a lever that you turned on the front panel.
Yes, you remember it.
It had the I meter.
It had a tuning eye.
Tuning eye, that's right.
Yeah, but they were not yellow there in the CAP, but I did have a yellow 6 meter one that I got when I joined the civil defense. I got a 6-element beam and the loan of a of a yellow 6-meter gonset with the features you just mentioned. It was actually a tunable receive and crystal transmit. I had the use of that. I actually only had that from 72 to 75. We really weren't using it functionally. We just had nets, and being in the mountains and not a whole lot of other people to talk with, it was pretty much just civil defense, not ham radio, that I used it.
When did you get your first license?
I got it, well, 65 years ago, in 1959.
At age 15?
I was almost 15 when the license arrived. It took 2 months from the time I took my license. I took it at the home of W1TIM with the other person. It was like VE is today, was W1WOL, Bill Mitchell.
For the novice?
Yeah, novice.
And what was your first call sign?
KN1LEC. I've always been K1LEC, but I was, for 1 year, I was KN1LEC.
So then you upgraded to general class?
Yeah, in 1960, I went to Boston because they didn't have VE back then. And I got my general, and then in 1978, I went back to the FCC there in Boston and got my advanced.
And what was your favorite operating mode when you first started? I mean, obviously, your operating mode was CW as a novice, but did you get on the air and did you like it?
Oh, I did. I didn't quite make Workdahl States as a novice, but I did enjoy it. And we did have 2-meter AM back then. With the help of W1TIM, I recapped an SCR-522 and built a huge power supply for the darn thing. And I was on 2-meter AM as a novice. And then actually, while I was still a novice, I built one of those little Heathkit lunchboxes. The little regenerative receive, HW30, I guess it might have been over.
So your first rigs then as a novice was the SCR-522 and the Heathkit lunchbox?
Those actually came after.
What was your novice rig?
My novice rig was a Hallicrafters S-40B, and I had two ARC-5s. I had one for 80 meters and one for 40 meters. I'd converted them to crystal control. I'd built a power supply for them. I was using them without any matching. I was only getting about 15 watts output, but I had good antennas. I had a full-size 80-meter dipole, and I had a 40-meter folded dipole, which was all 300-ohm twin lead and came all the way back to the shack to a 4-to-1 air coil Balun. And then I built a single 6L6. I think it was driven by maybe a 6AG7. Well, out of the handbook, I bought another 15-watt radio, a 15-meter. And with that, I had a hand-rotatable dipole that I built. That's what I was on the air with as a novice. And propagation was good then. The International Geophysical Year was just 2 years prior, and sunspot activity was still great. And 15 meters for me as a novice with 15 watts was worldwide over. I don't need to say over. Sorry about that.
And did you enjoy your novice experience?
I did. Yeah, it was a challenge. I never was a great code operator, but I did get my speed up to 13 minutes to go to Boston.
Is there something really memorable about your novice experience that you still think about when you operate?
Well, yes, and I have to throw in these call letters. K1LJL, Steve Worley, was a year ahead of me in high school, and we did a lot of things together. We really did. We became very close friends, and he went off to college a year ahead of me. But we still are in contact. Whenever we see each other on FT8, for instance, no matter what band, what time, we say hi. Facebook, I've got a lot of ham friends on Facebook.
There aren't people that are 25 years in, or do you think that maybe the QCWA doesn't have any benefit to offer anymore?
Oh, they are, but there are just too many other ways
of communicating.
Yeah, and I enjoyed it when I got in. In fact, I just got my 65-year certificate from them.
Who were the Green Mountain Boys?
The Green Mountain Boys were the Vermont Air National Guard. I joined the Guard in February of my senior year of college. They had a slot open for a ground radio operator, and I qualified, and I became a member of the Vermont Air National Guard in February of 1966 with my basic training and specialty training postponed until after graduation. I graduated on May 22nd, and June 5th I was at Amarillo Air Force Base for 4 weeks of accelerated basics. This was during Vietnam. It was hot and heavy. I was going to lose my deferment, so that's why I joined that organization. And I learned about the organization through a local car club I was in. I always had special interest cars, and I built a hot rod in the summer of 63 and stuff like that. So I got in with these car guys who actually rented a space in the next town over where we could work on our cars. In my senior year, my apartment included a garage with a cement floor, and that's a whole nother story. Can you imagine in 1965, 66, being able to rent a studio apartment, all furnished with utilities, with a single car garage with electricity and a workbench for $73 a month? Can you imagine?
No, I can't. Was that a good deal?
Oh, it was a fantastic deal.
What year?
I rented it for my senior year of college, and because I knew I was coming back to Vermont for on-the-job training, they waived Keesler. I normally would have had to go to Keesler for my school, but they let me come back to because I had my general license, they let me come back to the Burlington Airport, spend 90 days of on-the-job training under an NCOIC who was not a ham, but he knew Morse code. He could do 35 words a minute and hold a conversation with me at the same time. So he really helped me with it. I had a noontime CW net that I had to check into every day. And it was great. And it was during that time that I told you about that $100 ground school and 10-hour of dual instruction that was available on the other side of the field.
So it's my understanding that you decided to stay in the family business, at least when you left high school, or at least to train in an area of the family business.
Yeah, I specialized in what I was most comfortable in. I'd started working there at age 12. I mean, and that really gave me the funds to have decent equipment when I got into high school. While I was still in high school, I had a DX-100B and a Hallicrafters SX 101 Mark III, and I had a three-element Yagi, and this was 1960. This is the year that I met our mutual friend Bob Vinicor, W3CFE, or his stateside calls.
He's still using W3CFE.
Well, he does because he operates a remote in my old hometown of Springfield, Vermont. He has a OptiBeam at 70 feet and a TS-480 operating on a high hill in Springfield, Vermont.
So for the listeners, Bob Vinicor, W3CFE, was a guest in an earlier QSO Today podcast. I'll put a link to that in the show notes page. But Bob spends maybe 5 months in total in Jerusalem now. He brings his dog, and he has a remote control head for his Kenwood station that he operates remotely from Vermont. And it's very cool. He can check into his nets even from here.
Yeah, and he does. And I've talked with him via that link. In fact, I think you were in the shack one day when we communicated on FT8.
I was, as a matter of fact. Yeah, fortunately, he now has fiber optic service to his apartment there in Jerusalem, as I do. So internet service is actually very reliable and very good from Israel to the rest of the world. So that makes his station really robust. But he tells me that he also operates that remote station from his car through his cell phone. So That's also kind of amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. I've talked with him, you know, I've talked with him stateside, mobile, as he's traveled, you know, between Florida and Maine, where he also has homes.
Can we talk a little bit about the dairy business, if you don't mind? Because you're the first person that I've ever interviewed that's actually was in the dairy business, and I don't know much about it. So you started working in the family business at age 12. It seems to me that if you're going to go and train for, you know, additional learning in the dairy business, what was it that you trained in, and how did that manifest itself after?
Well, I could have gone to Penn State or Cornell or the University of Vermont in that program, but I chose Vermont. It was cheap. It was tuition was only $825 for two semesters, for a year. And it was only 2 hours from home. But in any event, it was more to pick up other things. I actually had more credits in ag economics, and my advisor was very liberal with me. I took business law. I mean, I got a lot of good education out of my 4 years at the University of Vermont. But my degree was technically in animal and dairy science with a specialty of dairy manufacturing. But the dairy industry, you know, can best remembered back in the day for like home delivery of glass milk bottles of milk.
Right, with those paper tabs that you couldn't scratch the pull-up. That was our challenge as children. I'm about 10 years younger than you, but I remember the bottles being delivered and the little paper cap had a pull tab. You had to scrape the pull tab up to be able to pull the tab up.
It was an early form of shrink wrap, I guess, up there at the top.
It was very clever.
Yeah. You know, there was a glass shortage during World War II, and that's when some conical shaped wet, because they could be nested, preformed paper, waxed paper cartons were, I remember we had during World War II. I mean, I was born 18 days after D-Day, so I certainly don't remember World War II. But again, it wasn't just gas shortage and sugar shortage and everything else during the war. There was certainly there was glass shortage, believe it or not.
And now this mid-show break. The future of podcasting and the QSO Today podcast is listener sponsorship. It keeps us lean and focused on providing you the best ham radio interviews since 2014. You can keep the QSO Today podcast commercial and sponsor-free by becoming a listener sponsor yourself. For $10 a month or save 20% at $100 per year, you can become a listener sponsor. I am now recording the QSO Today podcast as video interviews that are available only as a benefit to listener sponsors through our QSO Today community website. As I develop the sponsorship tier, I will add bonus content for listener sponsors. Listener sponsors, not donors, are automatically members of the new QSO Today Academy. I am building the Academy website to include access to our SQL I/O networking lounges all of the time, and Academy resources including over 400 previous expo presentations with Q&A, and additional helpful ham radio educational resources. The benefit of listener sponsorship as an alternative to commercial sponsorship is that commercial sponsors influence the content and comments in the podcast. Listener sponsorship allows a greater degree of freedom to discuss any ham radio subject without commercial consequence. I have eliminated all commercials in the QSO Today podcast from episode 445, with the exception of the Ham Radio Workbench podcast, as I think that this is a serious asset to a well-rounded ham radio education. I am not using Buy Me a Coffee or Patreon, but my own system for managing the community that could form out of the podcast. I direct you to the sponsorship section of the show notes pages beginning with the episode 444, where I list all of the contributors to the podcast since 2014, including sponsors, donors, and hams who have paid for transcriptions. If sponsorship is not your interest, then you can make any size donation to the podcast by clicking on the donation button on the QSO Today podcast website at qsotoday.com. There is a slider that you can use to adjust the amount of your donation. If you want to make your donation monthly, click on the recurring donation box. It is the recurring donations and the listener sponsorships that keep the lights burning here. Finally, you don't have to contribute anything to listen to the QSO Today podcast. You can use my Amazon affiliate link before shopping at Amazon by clicking on it on the right side of the show notes page. This will signal Amazon to send us a small percentage of what you purchase. This is the most painless way to ensure that the QSO Today project will be here next week. I want to thank everyone who has contributed and will contribute to my effort to create this oral history of amateur radio since 2014. It will eventually all be in the public domain for hams in the future to enjoy. Be sure to become a listener sponsor or make a donation today. And now we return to our QSO Today. Just out of curiosity, it seems to me milk production from cow to home delivery has a lot of steps in the middle, and also you have to sanitize the milk in some way, and you have to be able to filter and pump it into various things. I'm assuming that your dairy had all of this, and did you go to some kind of automation at some point?
Oh, yeah. We were probably, in terms of Vermont, not just New England, we were probably the most progressive in technologies. My family built a new barn in the 40s that pumped the milk from that were around the they built a barn that was strictly for milking, and it had automated manure extraction equipment in the floor and had around the plant pipeline and went into a bulk tank, which was way ahead of its time, instead of going into milk cans. Milk had been handled from the farm to the plant for years in 40-quart milk cans, heavy, 100-pound cans. And they were kept cold at the farm by whatever means they had, typically ice in these big vat sort of things. That was how milk was kept cold at the farm. But we built a new plant in 54. That plant never received a milk can. And we had two Brockway tank trucks that went around. My dad subsidized and financed bulk tanks for the farms that shipped to us, so that so they no longer had to handle milk cans, and that we didn't have to. And these two trucks collected milk, with sanitary pumps, and they were, it was brought back to the plant by truck. Yeah, milk was raw milk back in 1918 when my grandparents started, and the bottle washing equipment was in the basement of the farmhouse. That's how elementary it was. But it progressed into a pretty modern plant there at the farm.
And did you pasteurize milk there at the farm?
Yes, we were the first in our town to pasteurize, and that was in the 30s.
Just for me and the rest of the non-agrarian listeners, what does pasteurization mean?
Back then, it was vat pasteurization. You brought the milk up to 143 degrees for 29 minutes. That rendered, all pathogens dead, and that's how milk was pasteurized back. Pre-war. After the war, there was what was called HTST. It was it was pasteurized through plates that brought the milk up to temperature and back down again with great energy conservation, brought it up to 161 for 15 seconds. And that's what did the same thing. And that's the way milk is still pasteurized today. Regular fluid milk has to be 161 for 15 seconds.
So the milk comes from the cow. It's filtered for any solids?
No. Well, yeah, okay, yes, you're right. Back in, if milk was hand, you know, squeezed out of the cow teats. You know, it there was a filter pad in the bottom of the thing that was, I mean, out of the collection point. But no, the those teats were sanitized as these units were actually, these vacuum units were put on the cow. And there actually was no filtering as such along the way. There was no filtering.
There's a large dairy industry in Israel, and I can't say that I've been to many dairies, but there's one about an hour from here down in Carmel. Their milking operation sits on a carousel, and the carousel is actually like a boat in a tank that rotates.
Yes.
The cows actually enter. It's all automated. There's one guy that actually puts the suckers on the teats, but apparently the cows go in, they get hooked up, they kind of spin around, and when it's time for them to exit, there's a little jet of water that kind of squirts them in the face and tells them to back up, and they back up, and then the next cow comes in. I'd never seen anything like that before, but I thought what was interesting was when you got all these cows on there, there's a lot of weight on there, so you don't really have that on a bearing. You know, a bearing in the center of a carousel would be kind of hard, so this whole thing is floating in this round vat.
Yeah, that's come about since we were in, you know, we sold our cows in 1952. But I have seen an installation like that in Chandler, Arizona. Shamrock Farms is somewhat vertically integrated, and they've got a huge operation, as you described. It's a large milking operation. That's the only one I've actually seen. I grew up in Vermont, but there weren't many of those installations in Vermont. There weren't any mega farms like in California and Arizona.
Yeah, I could say that this is not a mega farm. I mean, the way that the milk industry works in Israel is that there's a lot of cows distributed over a lot of places. And there's one company that kind of collects it from all of these places. So you don't have to have 1,000 head of milk cows. You might have 20 milk cows. Maybe you need more than that to make it a business.
Oh, you certainly would, yeah. Even we were milking like 110.
To make it worthwhile. But if you went down the road another couple of miles, you might find another operation very similar, different community, but they've got their own cows and the milk gets picked up there too. So let's move on now back to ham radio. Professionally, were you always involved in ham radio as you were raising your family and finding your way around the United States?
Yes. Yeah, there were times when I was less active than others, certainly. I actually built a Heathkit station just as I was courting my wife, I was building that station. So... So that there was competition. That was in fall of '67. I'd been exposed to the Heathkit equipment way back. I'd built that Tour, and I'd built the DX100B, but I built the whole SB line separate. I had a transceiver. I built the amplifier, although I never used it. As I said, I got involved with a woman. And so it was, I did not have an HF station the first 4 years of my being married. So ham radio certainly took a back seat, but what had replaced it was I'd got into 2 meter FM and repeaters. And that was the extent of my ham radio activity at the time, you know, I got into it in 1966. There were two repeaters I could use, one on Mount Ascutney, which was basically line of sight, depending on where I was, and another one on Killington Mountain in Rutland, Vermont. I had a 25-watt bass rig, and I had a, can't remember the nomenclature, something 100, a little Motorola handheld, which was pretty compact.
That was the HT-100?
Yeah, I think it was.
Actually, it might have been the HT-200. Is that possible? It was brown and big? Or was it a luggy-talkie with a...
It was gray and not that big. It was quite a small brick.
Because I remember in those days, probably the HT200 was wide. It was hi-fi. If you opened it up, it had two boards in it. It had a transmitter and receiver board, two-channel, crystal-controlled. Then the HT220 was gray. It was smaller. It was single board. It could be fat or thin.
Maybe that's what I had.
The HT220.
220, maybe. I don't remember, but that's what I had for equipment, and that was until 72 when I got back on HF. I bought my grandparents' place overlooking the farm, and I put a Roan 45 on the end of the house, and so I was back in business again.
What did you like to operate once you were upgraded to general and advanced? Were you a DXer?
Oh, yeah. I've always been a DXer. In fact, I think my Libya card is 1960. I've been chasing DX. When I left Vermont in 1992, I had 313 countries confirmed. And, of course, by then, I mean, back then, it was all by QSL cards. It wasn't logbook of the world like today.
And were you a contester?
No, I have never been a contester. I'll participate very casually. I mean, when I was, for 20 years, I lived in an HOA in Cary, North Carolina, and my only antenna was a 20-meter dipole in the attic. But I'd get on contests just to make multiple contacts and expand my DX as I could. But I had HF gear with me wherever I was. I lived in West Springfield, Mass, and then I lived in Greeley, Colorado, and wherever I was, except for a stint when I lived in Marblehead, Mass, I was active on HF.
And when you're active on HF, were you a single sideband operator mostly?
Yes, exclusively.
So your favorite operating mode is single sideband?
Yes, it was. Today, I still enjoy it, but it's more of a challenge. I've always operated barefoot. I got my 338th country confirmed yesterday by a QSL card. I got Cocos Keeling. It's not in logbook of the world yet, so I'll have to have it field checked. But that brought me up to 338. But having been in it so long, I have 11 that have been deleted. And I don't mean just like East Germany, but like when the whole Netherlands Antilles got their independence, you know, those countries went away. And so I'm not on a roll yet, but that's my challenge, and I think I'll make it. Bangladesh is still out there, but there's two stations that are quite active now, and I'll catch them from Bangladesh. And then we have, seems like we have a couple others coming up this year with the expeditions. So I only need four more to get up to on a roll.
You just mentioned that you just worked a country that wasn't in the logbook of the world. It's because the individual that you worked doesn't have a logbook of the world account?
Right. They don't. So I PayPal'd money over to Latvia where they were from, and they sent me a card.
I see. Okay. So that's how you're going to confirm the conversation is by having their card.
Yes, and then I'll get it field checked. There are four field check people in this state, and one of them is right here in Searcy in our club. And so it'll be convenient for me to have him field check my cards. I've got 12 cards right now that I need to get field checked. That's the only all-time new one, but the others will be, you know, what we call band counters.
So if you were going to advise someone, Lanny, on how to log their DX calls, it could be an old timer like me, or it seems to me that there's a whole bunch of different ways to do logging now. Would you advise Logbook of the World membership, or are there other services? Like you can log calls. I see people that use the log on QRZ.com, for example.
I use that still. I used it even as a non-ping. Before I subscribed to it, I was using that as my logging, but I've always paper logged. And I still do, even though I use Ham Radio Deluxe. But Ham Radio Deluxe has added functionality, like it lets me know whether I've worked them before or pops up if I need them. There's an alert if it's a new country or a new band. And I do like HRD Ham Radio Deluxe.
Okay, so that makes sense. So you would advise somebody to have a logbook of the world membership.
Oh, absolutely.
Will the Ham Radio Deluxe log say both QRZ and logbook of the world if you wanted to keep track of, you know, have it in multiple places?
And club log. They all go in together, and it's all automated. It puts everything in club log, which is how you order QSLs in my case. And it also keeps track of scoring, and it keeps track of my Arkansas DX Association membership. It keeps me, you know, it lets me know my ranking in the club. I think maybe I'm number 23 in the club or something like that. But, you know, it's club log is a good tool.
To be honest with you, I haven't thought much about it, and maybe I should spend more time thinking about it. But does club log or the combination of these keep track of, let's say all you do is make contacts. You're making single sideband contacts, and you're making them around the world, and you're making them across the country. Does it kind of give you like pop-ups or indicators to say, hey, you're close to DXCC, or you're close to Worked All States, or something like that? Is there any product like that that kind of does the thinking in terms of you're just operating and all of a sudden now you're actually eligible for some paper to hang on your wall?
Well, no, there are no alerts like that, but you can log in to Logbook of the World at any time, and you can check your Worked All States by whatever filter you want. And you can check, you know, you can check your DX. You can check to see whether they've confirmed or not. You know, it's real easy to use. Logbook of the World is a great tool, a far departure from having to wait 6 months for a QSL back in the day.
No, that's true. Where they used to actually compare the two cards, right?
Yes. Yeah. And then you send them into the league. And of course, a lot of our exchange was through bureaus. And so that was more of the waiting process. You always kept envelopes on file with your bureau. I'm still in the New England bureau because I'm a W-1.
Oh, that's interesting. So as I recall, the way that bureaus worked is that you would give your cards to somebody at the club who had something to do with the bureau, and he would, I guess, forward a package to the QSL bureau where they would, it's kind of like a post office for QSL cards, right?
Yeah. Except no, the individual, we as hams each individually send our cards into the bureau. And I do it in batches. I only do it like every 6 months. And most of my card requests, I'll say 50% are from Japan.
Oh, really? Oh, interesting. Because they still like to collect QSL cards?
Apparently. And there are a lot of hams there.
And do you get them back also?
Yeah. I get them from through the bureau if they're just casual, not something I need right away and I'm willing to PayPal money for.
Yeah, because I think you probably, PayPal a few bucks in order to get a single QSL card from Latvia.
Oh, yeah, a minimum of three and more likely $4 or $5 to have them processed, and they put it in LOTW at the same time most of the time. In the case of this Cocos Keeling, this husband and wife who are operating over there, either are not on Logbook of the World or did not enter. And I knew that ahead of time. I knew I'd have to wait for the card. But it was not a long wait. I think I just sent, I think I PayPal'd them right around Christmas. So it wasn't a very long wait.
And the name of this country is Cocos Keeling?
Cocos Keeling. VK9CY was the station. And it was a new one for me.
So VK9 would put it down in the South Pacific?
Yeah. It's a territory of Australia.
Oh, interesting. I learn something every day.
They also operated Christmas Island down there, which was another VK9.
What are you operating today? What does the rig look like today?
Well, it's dual receive. I do run cat control, so I can't actually run two stations simultaneously, although it's capable of doing that if I wasn't running cat control.
What is the rig?
I have moved all the way up to a Yaesu Fox Tango DX101MP, the 200 watt one that it comes with a 50 volt power supply in the speaker cabinet, and It's the first radio I've ever had that wouldn't run on 12 volts, so I don't have that backup. But I do have a little FT710 backup radio. And the reason I have this equipment, even though I'm on fixed income and have been for quite a while, and I hope I'm not getting commercial where I shouldn't be, but this isn't over the air. I have been a Gigaparts chat expert for a little over 3 years. And with an agreement with the manufacturers, I can get a radio for half of list, but list is an unpublished high number. But I have to agree to keep it for a year, and I'm treated as a VIP customer, and I'm supposed to be demoing it. And I certainly have done that. And I certainly, after 43 years of ICOM HF gear, I, as a perk with Gigaparts, I borrowed in a rotation. I had to wait for it not for it to come back from a ham fest or something like that. I borrowed a Fox Tango DX10, FT-DX10, which I just could not believe. And that was in the summer of 2021. And so the next month, I got one through that program. And I kept it a year and sold it to our mutual friend Bob. And he has it there at his station in Maine. With a hex beam on a tower right on the beach. He's got a beautiful location there.
I want to take a minute to tell you about my favorite podcast, the Ham Radio Workbench Podcast, with George, KJ6VU, and now joined by Rod, VA3ON, Mike, VA3MW, Mark, N6MTS, and Vince, VE6LK. Every 2 weeks, George and company offer up a status report on the many amateur radio projects on their workbenches and explore projects on their guests' workbenches. This group is project active and prolific, covering many technical areas of amateur radio. So the next time you want a deep dive into ham radio electronic project building, or to learn about technology, tools, test equipment, construction techniques, and the rest, listen to the Ham Radio Workbench Podcast, available on every podcast player and channel. Use the link in this week's show notes page to get to the Ham Radio Workbench Podcast directly. And now back to my QSO. I have two questions. So the first question is, what do you use cat control for on your transceiver? Are you running a remote station?
No, it's not remote. I let the software run it.
So the software on your computer, like the logging and all that stuff, is actually running?
Right.
I see.
Yeah, either Ham Radio Deluxe or the regular free FT8 software, the WSJTX software, you run it cat control, and it moves you to the band, and you have to watch the waterfall and find a clear spot to transmit in, transmit a tone on FT8, but it's all computer aided. It's pretty neat.
So let's go then back to, what is a Gigaparts chat expert? Gigaparts is a dealer like Ham Radio Outlet or DX Engineering.
Yeah, like Ham Radio Outlet. And yeah.
So what does a Gigaparts chat expert do?
Okay, when, say you're shopping at Lowe's, is a big popular home improvement store, and or even Walmart. If you're on Walmart.com, there'll be a pop-up box that comes up and asks if you want assistance. Well, that's exactly what happens here. If you get onto Gigaparts.com, a pop-up will come up and ask if you want assistance. And if you click on it, then I get to chat with somebody. And even though we don't get compensated very well, there are these perks that I tell you about. And I do enjoy helping new hams. I mean, I had one this week who wasn't a ham yet, but he'd already bought an ICOM 730 and he'd bought a Hustler 5BTV, but he did not know. He wasn't licensed yet. And I didn't know he wasn't licensed. I said, "Do you have your general yet?" "What's a general?" I mean, I have people who don't even know. They don't know anything about coax connectors. There's so many people, but I enjoy bringing them along. And sometimes these chats will go for 30 minutes, and yet I'm going to be involved in one or two other chats simultaneously. So, but it, again, it has its rewards. We get a small token monthly compensation, plus the perks are great.
Right. Well, that's very clever. And hats off to Gigaparts for not having a chat bot, you know, that answers the question. Or does a chat bot kind of front end the...
No, it's all live. It doesn't start off with anything automated, like you say.
Like most places, yeah, where you, oh, I don't know the answer to that question. Let me get a live person. Yeah.
Yeah, it goes right to live. And when I got into it a few years ago, there were like a dozen of us active, but the perks have gone away. Unfortunately, with inventories have been harder to maintain, and I don't know that it's been more of a struggle, and we're just not as popular. And as I said, we used to get monthly prizes and quarterly prizes that were really significant. A quarterly prize could be a FTDX-10 or an Ameritron amplifier. We don't have those prizes anymore. It's a very, very competitive industry. In the case of a major piece of gear, they don't make a penny until they get compensated for the rebate that they've already extended. So, you know, it's you know, very slim margins, and they make their money on accessories.
I think I actually knew that from my QSO Today Virtual Ham Expo and talking to dealers. It's a very competitive business, and the margins aren't there.
Yeah. Gigaparts is building a new 5,500 square foot store. It'll open this year. And I'm not excited about it because they're adding some new things. They're adding photography, astronomy. I already introduced myself as being, I really want to just help with ham radio equipment, but I do get people who are computer builders and shoppers, and I'm not excited about having photography and astronomy thrown into the mix.
If somebody's on the ham radio portion of the chat, does it know where to assign it, or is it just a general chat? You push the button for chat, and maybe they ask a question, and how is it delegated, or it's not delegated?
It's not, but most of the shoppers are ham radio, and if not, they drop out right away when they get my greeting, and which is in a macro. I have about a dozen macros that I use to speed up my processes.
Well, that's very clever. As I say, my hat's off to them for that. And were you actually in hourly shifts, if you don't mind my asking, or when you just felt like you wanted to be helpful, you logged into the system and all of a sudden you're there?
You can freelance at any time, but you get more credit if you're committed and you commit to a schedule. We've got one guy in Florida who grabs a lot of the prime time. I have to be a little more flexible because I'm my wife's caregiver and she comes first. So I have to schedule a time or times when I predict I'll be available.
Well, my guess is that if Gigaparts is doing it, that there may be opportunities for hams, older hams, to offer their expertise in other portals of similar vein for some kind of supplementary income.
Well, Bridgecom certainly has great support for, you know, for that Anytone equipment, and they really have gone all out with their chat people. I mean, they great support, and I'm not sure, but I think DX Engineering may have chat people. I'm not positive about that. I really admire DX Engineering for their levels of inventory and their total support of the hobby, you know, much more into towers and antennas and heavier hardware than we are.
Well, I think, you know, without being an expert, I'm not. I think that our auto racing parts business is kind of creates all of those means of production, shipping and all that stuff. I think having it kind of hanging on the back of that really makes it a powerful sales and delivery engine.
Yeah, it does. And not everybody realizes that it's part of the ham radio store is just part of that facility.
Right, but they've got very good leverage in terms of being able to leverage all of those amazing sales fulfillment.
They do support DX better than all the rest of us put together. I mean, I know they give great door prizes for us for our annual meeting of their Arkansas DX Association. And I mean, so does MFJ. MFJ it does well for us too. But those two are very generous with their door prizes. That club is the statewide Arkansas DX Association, and it is ARL affiliated. And you, to be a member, you have to be a league member. Our local club, which is the North Carolina, that's where I'm from. It's NC. It's North Central Amateur Radio Service, NCARS, is also ARL affiliated. And, you know, you can pull them up on ARL.org if you're looking for a club, and it'll tell about us. But we are affiliated, but we don't require membership. But we do have a high degree of a high level of ARL membership in our local Searcy, Arkansas club.
What does your club look like? I mean, is it mostly old guys, or have you been able to kind of extend the range and include young people as well?
Fortunately, we have a very good mix. I think there's only one active member. No, now there are two active members older than I am. I'll be 80 in June. K4WPM, who's a little older than I am, and then W6NIM has just moved to Searcy, and he's in his 90s already, but he's coming to club meetings. So, you know, but we have a lot of young people, fortunately. Not real young, not in their 20s, but in their 30s and 40s. That, to me, is young.
Those are the new kids. What do you think your club offers that creates such a broad spectrum? Besides the meeting, do you have regular activities or trainings or things like this?
We have training pretty much on demand. We do have a lot of support. I mean, for instance, this field checker I mentioned, he and his wife poured the cement for my tower. I mean, we get a lot of local support on antenna installations, and I mean, we're really great at that. And then field day is a big deal. We really go all out for field day. We have, and we use that mobile command post. We set up a station there for people to operate who are eligible for that. You know, they've only been hams for a year, you know, that category, whatever it is. So I'll go over and operate with those guys, and just to show them the ropes, the new hams, when they realize they can reach out. And I remember there was a new ham, and he was had a little bit of mic fright, but I encouraged him to get on, and guess who he called? He called W1AW. And got him, but he didn't realize what he'd worked.
So you think that the reason that your club is so successful is because you actually provide hands-on support to hams that need help, regardless of their years in ham radio or their lack of experience?
Yes, it really makes a difference. And we meet every Saturday morning, and they have for over 30 years, for breakfast every Saturday morning. And it's just, there'll be as many people at breakfast sometimes as we have in a meeting. Well, a poor meeting or a good breakfast. But and we meet at a place that gives us our own meeting room. So that's been great. And we test. We offer testing every Saturday morning. There's always enough VEs there.
And you have test applicants every Saturday morning?
No, not every, but quite often.
Quite often, okay. And that adds to your club. So people like the social side.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I married a girl from Searcy, and I've been, you know, I've been coming back for 55 years, and I used to, if I was here over a weekend, which quite often, I would meet up with these guys. So I met some of them 30 years ago. My mother-in-law lived within sight of the Bible building at Harding University, and I would go to Buildings and Grounds and get a key to the utility closet that had the ham station in it back then, and I'd work, and they had a tower with a Mosley tribander on it back in the day, and I'd work my DX from there when I was visiting the in-laws.
But I guess, you know, when you're thinking about, you know, older people, I think one of the problems that I read about anyway, many older people are alone. They're lonely. their kids have moved away, they're not going to work anymore because they're retired. It seems to me that ham radio and a club that's active with social activities is actually a lifesaver for older people. What do you think?
It is, and a disproportionate number of people, I'm going to more of a statewide label, have lost their wives. I mean, I'm on hams over IP in a bridge with some guys over on the western side of the state. And the three that I talk with the most on hams over IP have all lost their wives. And that's true here in this town, too. The guy who started up, one of the club founders who started this new Facebook group, he lost his wife. And he's a crop dust pilot. And so he's got a real busy time that keeps his mind on other things. But come winter, he's got a lot of time on his hands, and he's back into ham radio, and he's back. He's got a 100-foot tower, and he's putting new antennas on that as we speak.
Because it's kind of given a new lease on his social life.
Yes, absolutely.
Did you see that during COVID, did your 2-meter repeater activity in Searcy kind of increase? Are people using more airtime, perhaps, to talk locally, or does it just look like they're using Facebook or other chat programs?
No, I really didn't see a pickup on 2-meter 440. Not significant. More recently, it's picked up because we have so many new hams, and of course the entry level, I mean, the entry activity is pretty much 2 meters. And I don't mean just with Baofengs. I'm surprised at what some of these new hams are buying. Oh, my gosh.
Like some of the top line Yaesu, Kenwood, ICOM stuff?
Well, like 991As because they think they got to have everything in one package. Or we've got three of these new hams who've bought those ICOM 705s, those QRP, SDR, you know, 160 through 440 radios. that's a lot of money, but you know they've almost bought them without advice. They think they need something, you know, a shack in a box. You know,
that's kind of where it's going. Especially if your XYL says that you only get a corner of the hallway closet.
Yeah,
that might be the right thing.
Yeah.
What do you think is the greatest challenge to amateur radio now, from your standpoint?
It is age. There's a common denominator there. That's a challenge. There's a lot of competition for our time. I mean, back in the day, people were, I mean, from a comparable technology point of view, a lot of people were into hi-fi equipment and stuff like that. But today, everything is computers or. I've got a neighbor here, one of the new hams. He's got all these applications on his phone. I can't believe. He pulled up one and showed who my last FT8 contacts were. It was on his phone. I mean.
Well, so do you think that people are busier with applications on their phone, trolling on social media, all this stuff, rather than having hobbies? I don't see that younger people have hobbies.
Yeah, that's right. We have tried to, even though they're only here for 4 years, we've tried to encourage hams. We've got posters up in a lot of places around the university. Harding University has about 6,000 total undergraduate and graduate students, and many of them, a high proportion, are dorm residents,
Right, it's a residential campus, yeah.
They've got a great station now. When the new science building was built, a station was built for the club, and it's totally underutilized. It's a shame because they've got an FT DX3000. That was donated by K4WPM and a new and replacing the old Mosley is a JK Navassa on top of that tower on the Bible building. And he paid for the coax and rotor cable to run across an umbilical from the old Bible building into the new science building. the new engineering building, and a very generous donation, I will say. I helped set up his station, and he's in a HOA on campus. He and his daughter and his daughter's in-laws built three of these in a brand new community, built three of these houses on, but they're all HOA. They're all 31 feet wide. They're all long. He and his daughter share a common backyard the way they constructed them. But in any event, we put a DXCC fan dipole in the attic, and he has a Kenwood TS-2000 at home. And I helped, you know, set it up. Actually, another ham, Craig Faith, hung the antenna for him in the attic. And the first station we worked with that Kenwood was Slovenia, and he got all excited about that. I wanted to try 15 meters first because it relies, the Alpha Delta DXCC fan dipole is 40 through 10, but it relies on a third harmonic for 15 meters. So I wanted to check that out first, and that's what I did. But in any event, long story short, you know, there's a lot of support in the community, and we appreciate what Bill K4WPM has done for the club, for the ham radio club on campus.
Lanny, do you think that there's an opportunity? I mean, I hear this from other communities that have college stations that seem to be inactive. Is there something that a local club could do to maybe integrate with a campus amateur radio club? Or does NCARS have its own station and so therefore maybe doesn't need a station?
We do not have our own station, and we could get card access to that, but we'd rather do it as kind of a group activity, like for the Boy Scouts and stuff. But we really haven't taken advantage of that. But that's a good point. It's a resource that is there.
If there were people like in the station a lot of the time, so that students who might pass it might have an opportunity to take a look in and see what's actually happening there. It seems like unless you're operating POTA, where the general public sees you, or field day, because you've let everybody know that you're there, most people maybe don't even know that ham radio still exists.
And that's why just this winter, we've put up posters about the facility and about ham radio. But I'm only aware of one guy, and he commutes from Sherwood, which is about 40 miles south of here. He commutes, so he's not even a resident student, but he's the only one who's shown any interest in that that I'm aware of, as I said, that I'm aware of.
What advice would you give to newer returning hams to the hobby?
Make antennas your most significant investment, because antennas make all the difference. All the difference. Don't just be satisfied with a 49-to-1 Bell and N-Fed antenna. Do whatever you can to get more antenna up in the air. And I found this development. We bought this house in the spring of, well, it'll be almost 5 years. 5 years. You know, I gave my notice at work 5 years ago today. I just realized.
How about that? Congratulations.
Yeah. I was on a video conference call, and I actually gave my boss my resignation, and I was on a video conference call being recognized for high gross. My second career was not dairy industry. I sold commercial vehicles for Rick Hendrick in Cary, North Carolina, for 22 years, and I enjoyed my job. But in the end, I was not being rewarded. I was always commission until my last year, and commission is the only way for a salesman to get paid. But I, even though I wasn't on commission that final year, I was being recognized for high gross. I'd still made the most money from the company for any salesman in the mall. And I gave my notice to Mr. Rick Hendrick himself, who's well known in NASCAR, and my executive general manager was sitting right next to me, and he just looked at me. He had no idea that I was going to pull that stunt and announce. I gave a 90-day notice that because I knew it'd be difficult to replace me. It was a real specialty, selling commercially in fleets and stuff. It was, I mean, I really had to know my product, and I had to know my upfits. I had to know, you know, my body companies, and I had to, you know, relate with, you know, I had a lot of general contractors. I had hospitals. I had a lot of companies that gave me a lot of repeat business. But in any event, that was the end of a second career. I had that first career in the dairy industry and a second one selling vehicles.
What's the DX Hog Award?
That's issued every year to a ham who has the most accomplishments or who works the most, just the most, the highest level of activity. And I got the award for the Arkansas DX Association, the year before this immediate one. And the way it reads is, you know, for breaking the East Coast, you know, it's tough for us to break the East Coast because it's another whole skip distance on, you know, depending on the band. The East Coast has such an advantage working, for instance, you guys. And, but I've done it all with barefoot. I've always had, I've never run an amplifier. And so I was just being recognized for a few examples like that. And the guy who got the award following me, who we presented it to at our annual meeting in November, was a new ham who set up everything with the absolute best of equipment, instantly had DXCC, and he bought a Flex, and he could operate it from his office. He owns a concrete company up in Northwest Arkansas, and he just the accomplishments are fantastic. And he was great at posting spots and helping the rest of us. So, and that's something that gave me some notoriety, is I posted a lot of spots on our reflector over email.
And what's a chi weenie, and how does it do wonders for you?
My wife and I have never had our own pet, but we decided we wanted a young female spayed dog. But you know what? At our age, humane shelters don't want to give you a young dog that will probably outlive us. So we had to travel 2.5 hours, and in this case, it was right at the beginning of COVID, to get this little Chiweeny, which is a Chihuahua dachshund, and she has been great for me. I mean, the exercise that I've gotten, I've lost weight, my knees. I used to, when I was working, I had braces on both knees. I do not have. I walk. We go out, you know, twice a day and walk the neighborhood. And she's just been so good for me. You know, she's not a dog that has to be groomed. She's a dog that likes shampoos. Can you imagine?
Yeah, I have one.
Oh, she enjoys getting cleaned up in the laundry room sink.
I have one that has a play date every Saturday morning at 6:15. They play for 15 or 20 minutes, and they're completely muddy by the time we're done. And I walk her home. I walk her upstairs. She steps into the bathtub and sits down, and I hose her down. As an exercise tool, it's better than a health club.
Yeah, for me it has been.
Well, I highly recommend a dog. It sounds to me like you're a dog believer too.
Yeah.
Anyway, Lanny, it's been a pleasure to talk to you on the QSO Today podcast. I'm grateful that you agreed and that Bob Vinicor, W3CFE, recommended that you come and be on the show with me. So with that, I want to thank you so much and wish you 73. Thank you for being on the podcast.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's been fun getting to know you, and I will mention that this was not our first attempt. You had a blackout as we were getting started 4 weeks ago, so this was a reschedule.
That's right. Every once in a while, usually it's weather related, but if the weather is severe, yeah, the power goes off here.
Okay, well, 73 from Searcy, Arkansas.
73, Lanny. Thanks so much. That concludes this episode of QSO Today. I hope that you enjoyed this QSO with Lanny. Please be sure to check out the show notes that include links and information about the topics that we discussed. Go to www.qsotoday.com and put in K1LEC in the search box at the top of the page. You may notice that some of the episodes are transcribed into written text. If you'd like to sponsor this or any of the episodes into written text, please contact me. Support the QSO Today podcasts by first joining the QSO Today email list by pressing on the subscribe buttons on the show notes page. I will not spam you or share your email address with anyone. Become a listener sponsor monthly or annually by clicking on the sponsor buttons on the show notes pages. Your value for value support is recognized on the QSO Today podcast and in the weekly show notes. Use our Amazon link when you shop on Amazon. Clicking on this link before you enter Amazon will allow Amazon to pay us a small commission on what you purchase. This is a very painless way to support the QSO Today podcast. QSO Today is syndicated on every podcast platform, including Spotify and the iTunes Store. Until next time, this is Eric 4Z1UG 73. The QSO Today podcast is a product of KEG Media, Inc., who is solely responsible for its content.